Welcome to Playing Yourself, The Rhetoric of Games, a podcast series produced by students in David Morgan's Play, Make, Write, Think class at Emory University.
If, as Bernard Suit says, a game is the voluntary attempt to overcome unnecessary obstacles, then why do games continue to captivate our time, attention, and disposable income?
In each episode, we choose one game to play with a critical eye, analyzing its rhetorical situation, the sorts of obstacles it creates,
the types of decisions players make in playing, the values or ways of thinking the game encourages, and the impact the game has.
We'll pay attention to the medium of games, as well as their messages.
And ultimately, we come to the question, when playing a game, are you playing the game, or are you playing yourself?
Today on the show, we have an episode produced by me, Jason Berger, along with assistant producer Michelle Cho.
Today, we're looking at the worst game we've ever played.
And this is a game that we have all played and we all hated playing. It is, of course, the SAT, the Standardized Achievement Test.
Well, personally, I never took the SAT and I took the ACT instead.
Yes, of course, we all think of these two going together. But for the purposes of this episode, as you'll see, we can look at them as one and approach them from the same lens.
Well, isn't a game supposed to be fun? A game's the last thing I think of when I think of the SAT, so how can this possibly be a game?
Yes, that's a great point, and I'm sure that's what everyone's thinking. So let's try to define a game and walk the SAT through this.
Sure. To do this, let's look at the definition put forth by author Jay McGonigal in her book, Reality is Broken. She defines a game as having four defining traits: goals, rules, a feedback system, and voluntary participation.
And it's easy to walk the SAT through these if we go backwards through them. So let's start with voluntary participation.
Well, despite common belief, the SAT is actually definitely voluntary because students are not required to take the SAT to get into college, and they're definitely not required to go to college in the first place.
Yeah, and it certainly has a feedback system. It is that so much dreaded number we get several months after taking the test. We're giving a score going up by tens between 400 and 1600, with a 1600 being a perfect score on the math and English sections together.
Additionally, there are also rules to the SAT, such as no calculator on certain portions, no cheat sheets, no phones, and so forth. And there has also been a change in 2016 when the College Board removed a penalty for wrong answers, along with several other big changes.
And lastly, there are goals to the SAT. These are the numbers that we try to shoot for, the scores we try to get and stress so much over. And one more point I'd like to add on to this definition is that a game has choice involved. We don't change the story or the script of the SAT, but I think we'd all agree that the decisions you make on the SAT affect your feedback or your score. So if we take the SAT as a game, this allows us to look at it with a whole new lens and open up to a whole other train of thought. So for instance, if it is a game, how does that change its value?
Well, high school students tend to view the SAT as so much greater than it actually is, and at least when I was in high school, I thought that I was required to get a certain score that would allow me to be accepted to my dream college. And until then, I would stress about it, my score, but seeing it as a game makes it seem so much less overwhelming and less detrimental to my college application.
Yeah, and the other side of this is that games can be practiced. The more you play them, you start to learn all the strategy to it, and you can find the patterns to the questions. I remember the more practice I did, the more I learned to observe these patterns more so than actually the content that was being assessed. And this makes them a little unfair. There's a lot of talk out there about the achievement gap based on what sort of tutors you can afford. So the kids who are able to get these tutors who explain all these patterns and types of questions to them and walk them through how to answer the questions based on their structure more than their content are able to do a lot better than the kids who are stuck stressing and worrying about the content that the SAT is allegedly assessing. And now there's a lot of discussion about this achievement gap and how the SAT isn't a fair metric and really just measures socioeconomic status and various other issues. And we won't get too far into that for the sake of this podcast. But we will look at how the value changes in other ways.
So, if we take the SAT as a game, why is it set up this way?
Well, the College Board is this really secretive organization, and we're never going to get a real answer. But we can take some good educated guesses at it. First of all, people really crave to rationalize and organize everything in our daily lives. Our brains are really designed to stereotype and group things together. So it sort of makes sense that we would create a model to rationally express a quantified measure of performance with this game.
We also crave validation through a number that defines and ranks our academic ability in comparison to our peers.
Yeah. It sort of makes sense that the SAT became a game, because games allow us to create models of behavior and thought processes.
So, consider the Olympic Games in ancient Greece. Those games were a way to model and rank people based on their aptitude for physical abilities.
Just like how the SAT is designed to measure students' academic abilities.
So, it's in our nature to create some sort of game to model a student's aptitude, even if the rationalization is somewhat undeserved.
So now, if we recognize these structural issues with the SAT, why is it that we're still using it as a test when it's more like a game?
Well, about 100 years ago, only 4% of high school graduates went on to college. But today, that number has skyrocketed to 67% of high school graduates, nearly 2 million students enrolling in college right after graduation. Today, high school diplomas are much less employable.
And with this reliance on college admission to be employed comes the test prep industry. And now this is a massive industry. Last year, it accounted for over $300 million in the U.S. alone.
Yeah, and that's just in the U.S., as students in South Korea, China, and other countries worldwide vigorously study to perfect their SAT scores, fueling a massive test prep industry even overseas.
So to really answer this question, why we use the SAT, just follow the money. The testing industry is huge and not going to just go away. And we don't really have another alternative, and there's so much money going into making us good at the SAT that it's really hard to take a step back and ask ourselves if we should be doing this at all, and if we should be breaking off into something different. And taking this with our previous reasoning about wanting to quantify students' academics leaves us with a strong incentive to stick to the test we have. And this sort of takes us back to a point from earlier. That is the SAT really voluntary?
Technically, the SAT is voluntary, but as more students choose to participate in this game seeking validation, the more others are inclined to conform, making the obstacles seem rather necessary.
Yeah, and this sort of makes the SAT really a perfect game. If we go back to the definition of playing a game by Bernard Suits, he said that playing a game is a voluntary attempt to overcome unnecessary obstacles. And it's hard to think of an obstacle more unnecessary to overcome than the SAT that we created. Thanks for listening to this episode of Playing Yourself. Once again, I'm producer Jason Berger.
And I'm assistant producer Michelle Cho. And a special thank you to our line editor, So Young Yu. As always, our sources are in the episode description.
Thanks again for listening.